The great teachers have taught, honor thy father and mother, cherish wife and child, protect the stranger and the guest. In Hindu ethics, there is a specific rule based upon their statement that God, the spiritual teacher, the father and mother, and the guest should be regarded as equal. I would like, with your permission tonight, to try to honor parents, cherish wife and child, and extend full friendship to the stranger and the guest. Just as the Buddha had his parents, his friends, his child, Buddhism too has its parentage and its relatives. First then, how to listen? The art of listening. This is from the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where the great teacher Yajnavalkya, who had two wives, the Martha and the Mary of that pre-Christian millennium, Yajnavalkya is about to leave his forest hermitage and enter upon the final stage as the homeless wanderer, giving spiritual wisdom wheresoever he went, to whomsoever desired it and was fit for it. Now then, Yajnavalkya had two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani. Of these two, Maitreyi was a discourser on Brahma knowledge, while Katyayani possessed only such knowledge as women have. Now then, Yajnavalkya, when he wished to get ready for another mode of life, Maitreyi, said he, no, verily, I am getting away from this state into the forest. Forsooth, let me make a settlement of his worldly goods, his hut and his one or two odds and ends, for you and Katyayani. Then said Maitreyi, my lord, if indeed this whole earth filled with wealth were mine, do I become immortal by it or not? No, replied Yajnavalkya, as the life of people who have plenty of things will your life be, but there is no hope of immortality through wealth. Then Maitreyi said, what shall I do with that by which I do not become immortal? What you know of the way to immortality, venerable sir, that indeed explain to me. Then Yajnavalkya said, you have been truly dear to me even before. Now you have increased your dearness. Therefore, if you wish, my dear, I will explain it to you. But as I am expounding to you, seek to meditate on it. Listen with the pacified mind. Now a few words about the end, because the title of this talk is The End, and also the beginning lie in the middle. And when they were come unto a place called Golgotha, that is to say, the place of a skull, they gave him wine to drink, mingled with gall, and when he had tasted it, he would not drink. And when they had crucified him, they parted his garments among them, casting lots. And they sat and watched him there. And they set up over his head his accusation written, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then are there crucified with him two robbers, one on the right hand and one on the left. And they that passed by railed on him, wagging their heads, and saying, "Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself. If thou art the Son of God, come down from the cross." In like manner also, the chief priests mocking him with the scribes and elders said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save. He is the King of Israel. Let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe on him. He trusteth on God. Let him deliver him now, if he desireth him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land, sixth hour being midday, until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And some of them that stood there, when they heard it, said, "This man calleth Elijah." And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. And the rest said, "Let be, let us see whether Elijah cometh to save him." The name Elijah literally means God himself. And Jesus cried again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks were rent, and the tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints that had fallen asleep, not dead, were raised. And coming forth out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now the centurion and they that were with him, watching Jesus, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were done, feared exceedingly, saying, "Truly this was a Son of God." Now late on the Sabbath day, as it began to dawn towards the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulchre. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord had descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone and sat upon it. His appearance was as lightning, and his raiment white as snow. And for fear of him, the watchers did quake and became as dead men. And the angel answered and said unto the women, "Fear not ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus, which hath been crucified. He is not here, for he is risen, even as he said. Come, see the place where the Lord lay, and go quickly and tell his disciples, he is risen from the dead. And lo, he goeth before you into Galilee. There shall ye see him. Lo, I have told you." There is a slight variant of that in another gospel. But Mary was standing at the tomb weeping. So as she wept, she stooped and looked into the tomb. And she beholdeth two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus had lain. And they say unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? She said unto them, Because they have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him. When she had thus said, she turned herself back and beholdeth Jesus standing, and knew not that it was Jesus. Jesus said unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou? She, supposing him to be the gardener, saith unto him, Sir, if thou hast borne him hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away. Jesus saith unto her, Mary. She turneth herself and said unto him, Rabboni, which is master. Jesus saith to her, Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended unto the Father. But go unto my brethren and say to them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father, and my God and your God. And in the Acts of the Apostles, first chapter, verse 8, Jesus is saying, But ye shall receive power when the Holy Ghost is come upon you, and ye shall be my witnesses both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and unto the outermost part of the earth. And when he had said these things, as they were looking, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of sight. One of the most vividly dramatic expressions of the nature of the end. From the Upanishads again, another type of expression, the Atma. Translate the Atma as the ultimate, the absolute, the indescribable. The Atma is all-fold, beginningless, endless, immeasurable, unchangeable, replete with being, consciousness, and bliss, decayless, the one essence, the eternal, delighting only in itself. The qualityless, the actionless, the subtle, the changeless, the stainless, the indescribable. The true nature of Atma is above the reach of speech and mind. Such also is Brahman, one only, without a second. He who knows the Atma through his own cognition is a Siddha, that is, one who has accomplished his object. Whither is this world gone then? How did it appear? Where is it absorbed? It was seen by me just now, but now it is gone. What a great miracle! In this mighty ocean of Brahman, full of the nectar of undivided bliss, I do not see, hear, or know anything. I am an asanga. That is, I am associateless. I am without any attributes. I am Hari, the Lord taking away sin, Hari means. I am the quiescent, the endless, the awful, and the ancient. I am neither the agent nor the enjoyer. I am the changeless and the decayless. I am of the nature of pure enlightenment. I am the one and the perpetual bliss. This science was imparted to Apantaratava, who gave it to Brahma. Brahma gave it to Gaurangiras. Gaurangiras gave it to Rekha, who gave it to Rama, who gave it to all beings. This is the teaching of Nirvana. And this is the teaching of the Vedas. Yea, this is the teaching of the Vedas. Thus ends the Upanishad. The great god Shiva, the third person of the Hindu Trinity, is answering the questions asked by his son, Kumara the Kartikeya, as he is called. When the Upanishads present teaching in this form, the meaning is this: he who has reached liberation is one who can enter upon and abide in that transcendent state of consciousness which was symbolically represented by one or other of the great gods or the members of the Trinity. It is man himself, having reached the transcendent condition, giving out his teaching in the form of the divine dialogue. That is what it means. Then Kumara addressed his father again, "Please explain to me the realization of Atma." To which the great Shiva replied, "I am the supreme bliss. I am solely of the nature of divine wisdom. I am the soul supreme, the soul quiescence, the soul consciousness, the soul unconditioned. I am the I that has given up I." I am beyond the reach of speech and mind. I am of the nature of the all void. I am the unconditioned, the permanent, and the unborn. And Kumara asks a further question, to which Shiva answers, "He who has become Brahman, who has attained quiescence, who is a great observer of silence, who is ever silent with the silence of the ultimate truth, who does not see the difference between I, thou, this, that, whose Atma is void, subtle, and universal, is one who has realized the supreme liberation. He is of the nature of the void. He is devoid of the thought of thou art. Who is without the thought, this is the ultimate." I read to you that verse from the Acts of the Apostles saying how Jesus ascended. In the Aitareya Upanishad, chapter 5, verse 4, it is stated of the great teacher Vamadeva, "Then Vamadeva, having ascended aloft from the world by means of the insight into the ultimate, became immortal." Yea, became immortal. And the Buddha puts the end in his own words. In the very first sermon that he gives, practically his opening words are these: "Hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been gained. I teach, I make plain the truth. If you walk as I teach, you will ere long and in the present life learn fully for yourselves, realize, and having attained, abide in the supreme fulfillment of Brahma faring, for the sake of which the clansmen rightly go forth from home into the houseless life. The deathless has been gained." And is the deathless the opposite of death? Perhaps not. Life contains within itself the balance of those opposing tensions, birth and death. But here is an insight into deathlessness and into what is the deathless. Because it says something about what happens to death. The great teacher Raikva asked, "O Lord, when this consciousness goes out of the body or the universe, what does it burn up and how?" To which the Eternal replied, "When it goes away, it burns prana, apana, vyana, udana." All this means just a list of all that constitutes the material universe and our existential life here and now. "Then it burns up earth, water, fire, air, ether. Then it burns," remember he says burns up, "the waking, the dreaming, the dreamless sleeping, and the transcendent states, as well as all the supreme worlds. Then it burns the highest world of all. Then it burns dharma and its opposite, adharma. Then it burns that which is beyond, is sunless, limitless and worldless. It burns avyakta, the illimitable. It burns akshara, the imperishable. It burns mrityu, death. And death becomes one with the great Lord. Beyond that, there is neither being nor non-being. This is the exposition of Nirvana, and this is the exposition of the Vedas. Yea, this is the exposition of the Vedas." So much for the end. Now for the beginning. Your beloved scripture. Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, "Fourfold in division are the good-doing ones who worship me, O Arjuna. The suffering, the seeker of wisdom, the desirous of wealth, remember, the good-doing ones who are desirous of wealth, and the wisdom attained. Now in the Mundaka Upanishad, it is said that he verily, who through his personal realization knows Brahman, becomes very Brahman. He crosses over sin. He crosses over sorrow. Liberated from the knot of existence here, he becomes immortal. Note carefully, he crosses over sorrow. He crosses over sin. Two great teachers dealt with sorrow and sin. The Buddha's teaching is concerned with dukkha, suffering, sorrow, and the deliverance from suffering. The Christ came to reclaim the lost sheep of Israel, to redeem the sinner. Suffering. What is the meaning of suffering? We have, of course, the conventionally presented first noble truth of the Buddha, the truth of dukkha. Now, O bhikkhus, this is the noble truth as to suffering, to dukkha. Jati, birth, the beginning of another condition or state of being, is sorrowful. Old age, decrepitude, is sorrowful. Disease is sorrowful. Death, the ordinary death that we experience, is sorrowful. Association with what is not dear is sorrowful. Separation from what is dear is sorrowful. The unfulfilled wish is sorrowful. In brief, the grasping fivefold aggregate, that is form, feelings, ideas, mental dispositions and patterns and consciousness, is sorrowful. That is the statement of sorrow, the meaning of suffering, as presented in the bare words of the first noble truth. The domination of death. Everywhere one sees this death, the most beautiful things pass away, the finest art, the most wonderful science, the sublimest philosophies, the profoundest theologies, they have a beginning and an ending. They pass away. There is no joy, there is no pleasure, no experience which does not run its course, come to an end, and leave an aching void and a craving for its repetition, with a sinking feeling, will this also pass, or will I have it forever and ever? I cannot have it forever and ever, is my experience. And so, this domination of death is sorrowful. But is that all? Is that all that the Buddha meant by suffering? Surely not. We didn't need a Buddha to teach us how to meet that type of suffering. Anyone worth his or her salt, stand on his or her own feet, face life, take it as it comes, deal with it, go on all that is possible for us. To be born into the world is inevitable. In which sense is that a suffering which needs a transcendental message or a transcendental realization in order to overcome that or to meet it rightly? In no sense at all. It's quite a common, normal phenomenon. Disease? Yes, we can take that in our stride. Pain? Decrepitude? Old age? Yes, it comes, it's painful, but we jog along. We can take that in our stride. We don't need a Buddha for that. But the injustice in the world, the suffering which millions go through, as we see, undeservedly, and even if deserved, the cruelty of it, the horror of it, is too terrible, too great. This is indeed suffering. Is that all the suffering there is? We start asking questions. The why, the wherefore of the deep things, we can't find answers. And there is suffering, intellectual distress. Is that all? There is still worse. We have found something worthwhile, something reliable, something which does not fail us. Love and friendship in a vision of life, in an established order of things that is good, as we say. And we come to a point when suddenly that foundation disappears. There is tremendous distress, distress which goes deeper than what the mind and the heart ordinarily experience. Is that all? There is still more. We tread the path. We see the Lord face to face. We enter into the jhanas, the deep states. We see with the vision surpassing mortal vision the truth of the great truths as propounded. Then we experience the dark night of the soul. Confusion, blindness, incertitude, instability, the great blank of the no thing. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? The plane of no thing, just stepping into the neither perception nor non-perception of the samapattis. As in Hindu terminology, it is the middlemost point of the sushupti, the deep slumber state of waking consciousness, not of being asleep, when all the verbal formulations have completely ceased. You've gone completely beyond the reach of speech first, and very nearly the deepest realms of the mind. And then, can you move forward into the transcendence? And if you can't, are you safe enough to come back? You don't know. It is the moment of danger. And the Lord of Death stands there for the last time. It's the last death that can be known. And if you go forward into the transcendence, which the Hindus call the Turiya state, They had the highest subdivision of it, which is called the Turiya Turiya, which the Buddha called Nirvana. You're all right. And if you can't, there is the ultimate final suffering. And you utter a loud cry and yield up your spirit, as put in Christian terms. Such suffering there is. But there is another, not of such intensity, but something here and now for us. This is connected with the beginning. Lovely story. Narada, the great sage, not yet a realized being, but the great sage, approached the teacher, the great teacher, Sanat Kumara. And when I say great teacher, I mean one of the same sort of stature as a Christ or a Buddha. And said, "Teach me, venerable sir." It's a bad translation, "teach me." In those days, when they approached the realized one, what they really meant was, by that word adihi, which of course ordinarily is translated as teach, what they meant was, demonstrate in your own being Brahman to me and establish me in that stage of consciousness. That was what the gurus could do to their chelas. "Teach me, venerable sir," he said. "Come to me with what you already know," said the teacher. "I will teach you what is beyond that." Narada replied, "Venerable sir, I know the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Sama Veda, the fourth Veda, the epic and the ancient law, grammar, propitiation of the fathers, the science of numbers, the science of portents, the science of time, logic, ethics, politics, the science of the gods, the science of sacred knowledge, the science of elemental spirits, the science of weapons, astronomy, the science of serpents and the fine arts. What do I not know?" "This, venerable sir, I know. But, venerable sir, I am only like one knowing the words and not a knower of the Atma. It has been heard by me from those like you that he who knows the Atma crosses over sorrow. Such a sorrowing one am I, venerable sir. Do you, venerable sir, help me to cross over to the other side of sorrow?" So this, the non-realization of the ultimate, this disjunction from the transcendent nirvana in full personal consciousness here and now, which is the true superconsciousness, is the real suffering. Disease, old age, birth, and all the rest of the little things. Mm-hmm. Yes. But this is the great suffering. If this suffering is not there, the most powerful dynamic moving us to the transcendent is absent or deficient. So this is the meaning of suffering. What did the Buddha seek in terms of finality? Not the solution of problems of disease, old age and all the rest of it. Social progress, human ingenuity, and such things can tackle all that. But this, the realization of the transcendent, nothing less than nirvana, the unoriginated, the all light. Do not mix it up with the universal unconscious, as I'm afraid Jung has done. He's put it in his own words in the psychological commentary to the Tibetan books. It's not that universal or collective unconscious that is there, the dark region, as the Hindus put it, the Hiranyagarbha consciousness. It's in that region there. But the transcendent, Nirvana, Brahman, is the all light, the realized through the unconscious matrix. It was that the Buddha sought. And this suffering, being away from it, not in it, was the suffering that moved him. And that is the meaning, the profoundest meaning of suffering for us as we are here. So, as we become sensitive to this suffering, there grows in us a poignant longing. In Sanskrit, mumuksha. Mumuksha, a poignant longing for the realization of that ultimate. Now, there is no selfishness in this, because the ultimate, the infinite, is not the particular or the limited. The realization by the limited and particular of the infinite overleaps all the boundaries of self and not self, of thing and no thing. We get tangled up into knots when we start talking about that which is approaching the transcendent realm in terms of the particular and limited, the empirical realm. This empirical realm, subject to birth and death, in terms of our own awareness of this empirical realm, has a vocabulary which does not apply and cannot apply to the transcendent realm. So with all humility, I suggest we do not talk about selfish nirvana. It's a self-contradictory term. There is no such thing as selfish nirvana. There is no such thing as comparing nirvana with a paranirvana. Comparison disappears. Comparison belongs to the realm of the limited and the particular, not of the infinite, the eternal, the absolute, the all void. We have to be very careful how we try to learn. There is an art in learning. There is an art in observing. There is an art in checking observation. Now, this tremendous longing moves us to it. This longing for liberation is the force that sends the prodigal child back home. You and I, we are all going home. And when we have reached home, we shall be normal, ordinary human beings for the first time. Because we shall have fully realized that each one of us is a son of man, a manasa putra, a manasa putra. The son of mind. The word man comes from manas, to think, the thinking instrument. And the manasa putra has taken the longest step to becoming the brahma putra, the son of Brahman, of Brahma, the son of God. in terms of the realization of the transcendent through the purified mind. So now we come to the middle. I have tried to suggest what is the end. I have tried to suggest the beginning, and now the middle. This longing which drives us, makes us move, orient our ship towards the haven, the saranam, the haven of rest, of refuge. Not, I don't like the word refuge. Sounds as if you are running away from something. But the haven. You have arrived at the haven. The place of realization, of fulfillment. You have brought your goods. Brought the wealth of your whole being to that haven. This longing works in the meeting place of those two secret lovers, the end and the beginning. The end and the meeting place is life. Where is life? Here now, right in the middle, both in terms of time and space, of cause and effect, of substance and that which has gone beyond substance. Here now, right in the middle, is life. Life is that mystery play, that divine drama of the transcendent source involved in unconscious, inconscient matter, wholly unawake, emerging into triumphant realization of the transcendent goal, which is to become wholly awake to nirvana. And that is life. And that happens from moment to moment, here now. Whether we see it or not, whether we are aware of it or not, it happens all the time. That is the nature of life. If we may pretend to represent it pictorially, the transcendent source, or if you like to put it this way, the transcendent source, life and the goal, the meet here. Now just a few brief words, about life. Life is composed of dharma and karma. Karma, its first meaning is action. Comes from the root kri, meaning to do. Karma is action. And this action takes place in a universe which is characterized by movement, motion, what in Sanskrit is called rajas, together with inertia, impediment, and when it comes to its right state, it achieves harmony, the harmony of a dynamic poise. a dynamic poise. This is the whole of karma, and it affects all planes of being, the physical, the psychical, intellectual if you like, the spiritual. It affects all planes of being. And our specific task is to bring life into this state of dynamic equilibrium, this harmony. That is karma. Now, karma works through the interplay of the polarities, the beginning and the end. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. This is the basic meaning of the teaching of rebirth. And how does it take place in human life? Whatever the other meanings are, here is a fundamental meaning which affects us here and now from day to day. A meaning as taught explicitly and clearly in the Upanishads. It is the meaning which does not concern itself in the reincarnational sense. Because if we examine the reincarnational meaning, we shall find ourselves in difficulties all along the line. That type of meaning also has a profound truth, but so profound that I can't put it into words, as yet anyway. And I've never yet come across any satisfactory verbal expression of that meaning, the reincarnational. But here is a real meaning. It is clearly stated in the Upanishads, the Maitri Upanishad for instance, samsara, the cycle of births and deaths, is just one's own thought, meaning the stream of consciousness. With effort, one should cleanse it then. The great teacher Sri Rama says in the Muktika Upanishad, the silent ones know as vasana. Vasana means mental impressions. Mental impressions in the same sense of the personal unconscious and all that sort of thing that modern psychology talks of. That which is manifested through the consciousness of objects, which is of the nature of the object itself and is the cause of the uprising and ending or fluctuations of mind. In the Maitreya Upanishad, the great teacher Sakayanya teaches, to a mind that has attained quiet and truth and which is not affected, that is to say disturbed, by sense objects, the events that occur to it through the bondage of karma are merely illusory. It is mind, the fluctuations of the mind alone, that is samsara. It should be cleansed with effort. One whose mind is thus cleansed attains the indescribable bliss. And the Sandilya Upanishad says absolutely categorically, when the fluctuations of the mind cease, the cycle of births and deaths comes to an end. Now there is one meaning, I say advisedly, one meaning of the doctrine of rebirth. Birth, death, birth, death, samsara is the original, it's the doctrine of samsara. Karma, the karmic world process, and karma is a single word to express the totality of the becoming process on all planes of being, is worked out in terms of this fluctuation. Birth, death, birth, death, beginning, ending, and so on. This is samsara. Now, you and I are aware of existence in these terms. In the terms of any experience, thought, feeling, event, beginning, preceding, ending. Beginning, preceding, ending. We are conscious in the mode of mortality, as I like to put it. It's in the mode of mortality. When these fluctuations can be stopped, as we say, then the cycle of births and deaths comes to an end. They are stopped in profound slumber, but we have no control over that. So what is the use of an immortality of which we are wholly unaware? None at all. Because when we awake, once again, we are caught up in dukkha, in suffering, in irresistible, uncontrollable reactions to any stimulus, external or internal. So we are born and we die, we are born and we die. But as and when, through the great religious disciplines, of which the Buddhist method is one of the most remarkable in this sphere, we learn how to stand apart completely from samsara and maintain that inward dynamic poise, then even the verbal formulations will cease, all speech will cease, one can go completely beyond the reach of all mind, remember, and enter the transcendent state. If once that transcendent state is realized, here and now in full waking consciousness, that is the purpose of the discipline of contemplation and samadhi and so forth, then that person always maintains that immortal awareness of eternal being here and now. The Buddha, in one of the discourses, categorically states that he lives constantly in that state. He tells that, I believe, to Aggivisena. Yes, it's one of those discourses. This is the transcendence of birth and death, of samsara. The flux of events will, of course, go on. But no longer will it be the sullied consciousness of the imperfect man struggling towards holiness. When we are aware of a sight, a sound, a taste, a touch, a smell, a memory, an anticipation, a process of thought, or whatever it is, that is always related to the forces of greed and hate and illusion in ourselves. When the purification is there, the foundation for peace, for the pacification of the turbulence of the mind is laid. When the mind itself attains that pacification, the disjunction from birth and death is attained through the integration of the two into the unending wholeness, the dynamic equilibrium. And we are aware of this. We live in this awareness. And some of the signs by which you will know whether you have attained or not are these. In your waking state, you will have no fantasies whatsoever. In your sleeping state, when you are asleep, you will have no dreams whatsoever. At any time, anywhere, you will never be unaware of the complete interrelationship between yourself and every object and every person and the total situation around you. There are some of the great signs by which you will know that you have realized this immortal mode of awareness. And this takes place in that middle region, life here and now. So this transformation of our mortal mode of awareness through life is the objective of all that the great teachers gave us as our spiritual heritage, compelled by their Mahakaruna and Mahaprajna.
Let me close with one comment in our speaker's own words. I look back into my notebook in the first lecture I find of his in 1957, has this: how shall we live the spiritual life and the working life together? And the answer is itself an immortal phrase. Meditate on it. Easily, say, when I forget to be myself. Tomorrow morning you shall ask your questions.